Iowa Public Radio is fundraising right now, and we could really use your support. The pace of news will not let up, and neither will we. Show your support for this service when you donate now at iowapublicradio.org. Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let me start off by just looking at the headlines, the updates from the New York Times webpage as of this hour. Pelosi threatens impeachment if Trump doesn't resign immediately. President Trump will not attend President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. With less than 2 weeks left of Mr. Trump's presidency, a wave of resignations hits his cabinet. We've all been soaking it up here after the shock on Wednesday. Let's get a perspective on this current political crisis from a well-known Iowa Republican leader. Doug Gross joins us for the first part of our program. He's an attorney, a farmer based in the Des Moines area, also well-known as the 2002 Iowa Republican gubernatorial nominee. Doug Gross, welcome back to our program.
Good to be on. Thank you.
Last time we spoke was mid-October, weeks before Election Day. I guess early voting was underway then. You told us then, quote, he may be a disruptor, but he may also be a destroyer. Our focus then was mostly on the future of the Republican Party. Your reaction to this week's insurrection and the president's part in it?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's outrageous, and he needs to be held accountable for it. He clearly incited an insurrection against his own government, against our own government. And the folks were attempting to certify the will of the people. You can't have much worse crime is in our country than that. So clearly he ventured over to the destroyer side.
Tell us about reaction you've seen in the state. Governor Reynolds condemning the violence by these pro-Trump extremists. We're finding out more and more about them every hour, and how well planned this was weeks in advance. This was nothing hidden. Anybody paying attention could have seen it. The governor said we all have a role to play in dialing down the rhetoric, but she didn't condemn President Trump's unsupported claims about widespread election fraud that helped incite this mob. She said the concerns of voters who don't believe that the results were accurate needed to be addressed. What's your reaction to the government's leadership on this?
That's bunk.
Bunk.
We all know that's not true. What's that?
Bonk. I was just repeating your word. Bonk. Tell. Elaborate on
bunk.
That.
B-U-N-K.
Bonk. Okay.
I mean, this was incited by people who were misleading citizens of our country into thinking something was true that wasn't. Our party is at a crossroads. There's always been two strains of conservative thought. One thought is the folks who feel that they want stability, they look for change in incremental and pragmatic ways, and they want to protect our institutions. There's another segment of conservative thought in the Republican Party that is much more ideological, that focuses on radical change, that wants the things to go back the way they think they were, in this case, pre-Civil War. That's a very destructive, that can be a very destructive impulse, a very destructive a portion of the conservative thought stream and of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And what Donald Trump did was give voice to that, inflamed it, misled it, and activated it. He needs to be called for that. He has to be held responsible. And unfortunately, I don't think the party today in Congress is prepared to hold him responsible. I don't think, well, the Democrats may say they're going to hold him responsible. I don't think they really have time to. And I think that'll just inflame and make partisan divisions even worse, which we don't need right now. I think the responsibility to hold him accountable is going to be right here in Iowa, the first in the nation caucus in 2024. If he wants to run again, we Republicans need to send him a message that we don't want someone who lies and destroys our most cherished institutions to be our candidate again.
And yet we know through polling and press reports that he has still the backing of millions of Americans, also many Iowans. How do you address the doubts among voters of this election's integrity, if not by simply stating the truth that these were, by all accounts, the so many checks in the courts, the recounts, that these were free and fair elections, period? What do you do with the disinformation that is embedded in millions of minds?
It's very, very difficult. I mean, because people, this strain of thinking, this strain of our party, and again, the Democrats have a strain that's that way on the left side, and that believes in radical change as well, and distrusts all leaders associated with the current situation. We both have this. These are strains that have been in our country throughout our history, and we've always called on our leaders. I mean, Madison recognized them as they were drafting the Constitution, trying to create a system in place that would moderate those and protect our institutions from that radicalization. We've always called on our leaders to make certain that at the end of the day, they understand the greater good, the importance of protecting our freedoms that are enshrined in our Constitution and our institutions, and to make certain that they don't allow, at the end of the day, when they're called upon to make a decision between their own interests and the interests of our country, they choose the latter. And it's only if we have leaders who are called in that fashion, who will let people know what the truth is, that we will overcome this. And it'll take time. You can't beat this propaganda and this big lie overnight. It's going to take time. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a lot of healing.
Are you hearing that from Iowa congressional leaders, Republicans, from our governor, the strength, the message that you just talked about?
No, she needs to say it. Now, I was pleased that all our Republican representatives in the Congress voted to certify the electoral results. Trump won here by 8 points. That would have been easy for them to go the other way. They didn't do so. So I'm encouraged by that. At the end of the day, Iowans are much more on the side of conservatives who want to protect our institutions, who want to protect our freedoms, and want pragmatic incremental change. And I think our Republican leaders in the House and the Senate did recognize that at the appropriate time when they were called upon to make that vote. Mm-hmm. But I just recall I don't know if you watched Mitt Romney's comments during the certification process, but that's exactly what Mitt called on our leaders to do. The best thing we can do for folks who are disaffected right now is tell them the truth. Stop lying to them. All our leaders need to do that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw this survey by YouGov Direct, a survey of some 1,400 registered voters released yesterday.
Hello?
Yes. Do you hear me, Doug Gross? Do you hear me?
Hello?
Okay. We seem to have Doug cannot hear me anymore, evidently. We'll try Hello? Here for a few moments. Doug not hearing me. Rachel Payne Caulfield is with us. We'll perhaps connect Doug Gross again. Rachel, do you hear me?
I do. Do you hear me?
Yes, I do. Very good. Okay. That we'll perhaps have Doug Gross join us again here, but you were listening in on that conversation, about to be invited in. Tell us about your reaction. Let me see. I think Doug is back. Doug, are you there?
Yeah, I don't know when I was cut off. I was certainly being eloquent talking to myself, apparently.
We heard most of what. It's just a very, very, we'll chalk that up to QAnon, maybe. I don't know. A bad joke.
We don't know, do we?
No, we do not know. If you could stay there for a moment, Rachel, I had Rachel on too. But
okay,
Doug, I just
sure.
wanted to have you respond to, perhaps you saw this survey from YouGov Direct released yesterday, some 1,400 registered voters in the country, showed almost half of Republicans support the pro-Trump protesters who stormed the U.S. Capitol. I looked at that number, 45% of Republican voters backing the attack, the insurrection on the Capitol building, takes your breath away. What do you make of that poll number, and what does it tell us about the future if that is an accurate reflection of the division in this country?
It is an accurate reflection. I'm very sad to say it. It's an accurate reflection of a number of Republicans, even in our great state of Iowa. And it's reflective of the fact that these folks feel like they've been left out. They feel like that culturally that the world has changed around them and they don't recognize it. They feel like that the elites just tell them what to do and expect them to fall in line. And that level of disaffection then has been inflamed, incited by a president who played them like a fiddle. And did 4 years of that, now going on 5 years of that. And it's very sad because it's all based on lies. The only way, we're not going to solve that overnight. And from a party standpoint, it's obviously very, very disturbing that such a large measure of our folks would feel that way. And it's also disturbing that a number of our leaders have taken advantage of that disaffection and made a deal with the devil just for purposes of power. But what we really need to do is address their underlying concerns and their underlying issues and listen to them about what the concerns are here. Help them with education. Help them get better jobs. Help them understand that the world as a diverse place is a more welcoming place. But only leaders can do that. And they can only do that with their voices. And they can only do that with their consistent voices. They can't do that with consistent lies. And that's what we've had for the last 5 years. So if our Republican Party is to be anything recognizable going forward, our leaders today need to step up and tell the truth.
12 days until Inauguration Day. Share with us in closing, Doug Gross, your worst fears, what you'll be watching, and your hope.
My hope is that instead of going down the path of the 25th Amendment and impeachment, which will further inflame partisan divisions, and my concern about this long term is in politics, usually there's a dive to the bottom. So if these kind of lies work for one party, you can tend to see another party try to use them to get to an advantage as well. I just hope and pray that doesn't happen. I also think what we need for Donald Trump and the Republican Party is the equivalent of St. Helena, where we put him on an island and let him there by himself, and that we never see, hear, or recognize him again. That's the best thing for the Republican Party.
Doug Gross, attorney in Des Moines, 2002 Iowa Republican gubernatorial nominee. Thank you very much again for your insights, Doug Gross. Take care.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's get Rachel Caulfield back into the mix after that technical hiccup. Thanks for standing by there, Rachel, professor of political science at Drake University. I hope you're still there.
I certainly am.
Thank you. React. We've been touching bases with several political analysts. So much is happening. A gush of news since that shocking day, Wednesday, the U.S. Capitol insurrection continues to shake our nation. By the hour, we have updates in our news. What are the most pressing things on your mind as a political scientist?
Well, I think that there are, first of all, as Doug noted, what this means for the future of the Republican Party is going to be a really interesting question, and I'm not sure we know yet. There is a genuine concern that I think needs to be taken seriously among those who feel as though their communities are disintegrating around them and government doesn't appear to be addressing their issues. They are angry. They find community online. And that sense of community that doesn't exist in their hometowns, it does exist in this rage and anger and frustration, this outpouring that we're seeing. And it's dangerous and it is disheartening. And I think what a lot of us are trying to do at this point is to figure out how the Republican Party puts it back together again, right? How do you consistently provide that voice of reason that includes a genuine concern for the well-being of a wide variety of people, but doesn't stoke this kind of anger and frustration. So I think that's the first thing that I'm watching. The second thing that I think has been really interesting in the past 2 days is the degree to which we're all struggling to come to terms with what we witnessed. I know, like a lot of people, I was glued to my TV trying to make sense of what was happening. A lot of people are using various terms to describe it. They're trying to find analogies to other moments in American history. Is this like Pearl Harbor? Is this like the 68 Democratic Convention? Is this like 9/11? Right? I mean, we're hearing so many different ways of trying to make sense of this. And I think what we have to remember is that this was truly unprecedented. We have never seen anything quite like this. A lot of people have noted that the U.S. Capitol has not been breached since the War of 1812, and that was by a foreign enemy. We've never seen anything like this. This is truly a new moment in American history, and it's one that we're going to have to make sense of over a long period of time.
Right, and I think your reference to 9/11 is not far off. Of course, that was an attack from outsiders. I was on that day, broadcasting as well, and I remember struggling with my emotions, as I have this week on the air, It comes with also a knowledge of people power. When you get a certain mass of people decided to just do a certain thing, and I've covered the peaceful revolutions that happened in East Germany in the 80s, in the late 80s, and also in Czechoslovakia. So I have been in the middle of this. I know people power when I see it. I saw it on television there, and this time it was not directed at throwing off. In that case, it was directed at throwing off an authoritarian government. Here, it's a different thing. Rachel, what moments, what images stand out for you from Wednesday?
Well, so I'm a nerd. I was very happily watching the chamber proceedings on C-SPAN and took a brief break to look at some other news outlets just to see how they were covering the count. And that's when, of course, I saw this huge crowd of people. You know, I, for years and years, attend inaugurations. I've attended the past six inaugurations. I know that scene well of the beautiful platform that they construct on the east side of the Capitol. And so to see it overrun by people in that way with such blatant disrespect for the property, the decorum, the gravitas of that government space, it just continually struck me. And of course, then to see the images of people inside the Capitol, inside congressional offices, inside the chambers, that struck me as absolutely shocking. I've never seen anything like it, largely because of the profound sense of disrespect that was being exhibited to, you know, so many people have used the word temple of democracy. I tend to avoid that kind of mythologizing of our government spaces, but it hurts to see it, to see that disrespect.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the apparent break between President Trump and Vice President Pence. How important is that, and what do you see possibly going forward because of it?
Well, so the break between the president and the vice president appears to have started, of course, a few days before Wednesday, when the president seemed to be kind of throwing the vice president under the bus and saying, you know, he's weak, he's unable to stand up and do what we need him to do, which is to, of course, not accept the slates of electors from various states. And so at that point, you started to see this question of how far will Mike Pence go in stepping up to perform this constitutional duty in the face of opposition from the president. And of course, Mike Pence has been such a loyal vice president. Virtually everything he starts, every sentence he starts is, you know, and I know I speak for the president as well when I say X. He's been a kind of spokesperson for the Trump administration. And to see him walk onto the chamber floor while the Trump rally was going on, knowing that he was there to perform this constitutional responsibility, was a significant moment in kind of seeing this break between the president and vice president. And of course, since that time, we have heard any number of stories about the degree to which the vice president assumed responsibility for speaking to law enforcement agencies, speaking to government officials throughout the events of Wednesday, whereas the president was not a part of those conversations. And now we're, of course, hearing a number of aides to Mike Pence express their frustration at the fact that the president didn't even check to make sure that the vice president was safe and secure while this insurrection was happening at the Capitol.
Right. I don't know if you've heard the audio there. The rioters were inside. There are recordings of the rioters because they had heard in the previous 2 days, of course, that Pence was not completely on board with President Trump doing what his wishes. And there were shouts in the halls of the Capitol, "Get Pence, get Pence." And so what you say is amazing. A riotous crowd trying to seek out the vice president And then you have a president who afterwards does not even check on the well-being of his vice president. That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing.
It's amazing. It's amazing to contemplate how that divide, that rift between them played out in a relatively short span of time, or at least publicly in a short span of time, and really culminated in this dramatic moment or series of moments on Wednesday. And of course, now the vice president is the one who would be charged with convening or speaking with members of the cabinet to determine whether or not it's worth filing a letter indicating under the 25th Amendment that the president is unable to discharge his responsibilities as president. It doesn't look like the vice president is interested in doing that. But nonetheless, the anger and frustration that we're seeing from Pence and Pence aides, I think, is really, really important. It'll be interesting as well to see the degree to which this changes any possible 2024 prospects for Mike Pence, because mm-hmm. I think inside Washington, it's well known that he is interested in running. This break with Donald Trump could be a defining feature of how he is viewed within the party, but also within the country.
Mm-hmm. We have less than 2 minutes, Rachel. I wanted to ask you about how our Iowa leaders, particularly Republicans, are reacting. Just a moment ago, Randy Feenstra, the new 4th District Congressman, sent out these few sentences. "We are at a critical point in our nation's history, a time where both parties need to come together for the good of the American people. Any effort by the House to impeach President Trump will only deepen divisions, and I strongly oppose any attempt to remove the president from office before the end of his term." What is the, I guess, tightrope that Republicans are walking? I guess that's the correct term, isn't it, the image?
Yes, that's the right term. This is a tough spot that they're in. On one hand, I think a lot of people realize that efforts to remove the president at this late date will be fraught and will stoke anger and resentment and partisan division. On the other hand, they clearly want to distance themselves from the violence that happened on Wednesday. And so it's a difficult spot that they're in to negotiate that going forward, recognizing this deep divide within their own party.
Okay, Rachel Caulfield, we'll have to leave it there. Professor of Political Science at Drake University, Rachel, we will be talking in the coming weeks numerous times, and we are so glad to have your expertise as a political scientist. Take care, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after a short break, Katarina Sestarek gives us reaction from Iowa political leaders to the events in Washington and a preview of the 2021 legislative session that starts on Monday. When we come back, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight. That's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, against the backdrop of our nation coming to terms with the invasion and occupation of the U.S. Capitol, incited by President Trump, the 2021 session of the Iowa legislature starts on Monday. Let's get a preview from IPR's Katarina Sestarek. I spoke with her earlier this morning. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Well, tell us about the reaction from state leaders to the shocking events in Washington.
So Governor Kim Reynolds, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, and House Speaker Pat Grassley, who are all Republicans and the top leaders at the State House, they all condemned the violence on the U.S. Capitol Hill this week. But in further comments, speaking to reporters, Governor Reynolds, she didn't condemn the underlying false claims of election fraud that were, you know, definitely part of what incited that mob to attack the Capitol during the counting of the electoral votes. She kind of said there's still a lot of questions about the presidential election. She did refer to Biden as the president-elect, so she doesn't seem to be questioning that he is the official winner. But she said there's a lot of people in the country who don't believe the election results and that their concerns should be addressed and that there's still a lot of questions about the country's election process. Of course, a lot of these doubts are based on just lies and completely unsupported claims about widespread election fraud. And there have been dozens of court cases by Trump and his allies that have been rejected for not having evidence of these claims. So, I guess Governor Reynolds is still expressing sympathy for people who have those views.
Right. And she was asked if she regrets her closeness to Donald Trump. What did she say there?
She didn't really answer that. She just said, let's stop pointing fingers. She said we should all tone down the rhetoric and come and get off social media and come together and talk out these issues.
Okay, let's talk about the legislative agenda quickly in a minute or so. For Republicans who remain in control of both chambers, what will they be addressing? The COVID pandemic, I assume.
Right. They haven't really said anything specific about what they will do regarding the COVID pandemic. I mean, they see as already having taken a big step. When they met in June, they passed a bill that gives liability protections from lawsuits to businesses and schools related to COVID-19 claims. So they thought that was a big step they needed to take, but they've already done. They haven't made any commitments in terms of providing funding for COVID relief. The state did just get some more federal funding for COVID-related issues. So Republican leaders are kind of saying, you know, let's see what we can do with that before trying to put more state money into it. Mm-hmm. One thing that's partly related to COVID that Republican leaders have been talking about is what they call parental choice in education. So Republican leaders are saying that they want there to be an option for students to go to school 100% of the time during the pandemic. Some schools, you know, have a hybrid option, a majority in-person majority of the time option, but not a full-time in-person option. So they are considering legislation that would force schools to provide a 100% in-person learning, but also still have, of course, provide a choice of fully virtual as well. Mm-hmm. And then other than that, I would say some big news that came out of leaders speaking to reporters yesterday was Governor Reynolds said she won't propose her Invest in Iowa Act again this year. There's just too much uncertainty with COVID.
Mm-hmm. Last year, we remember that the lawmakers had to suspend the 2020 session when the pandemic first hit Iowa in March. Briefly tell us, how will legislators meet safely during this pandemic?
Well, they're still going to meet pretty much fully in person. The legislature is open. The Capitol building will be open to the public. There will be more social distancing. Some things will be slightly different. The subcommittee hearings, which are usually like the biggest point of contact for lobbyists and the public to come and share their concerns about bills with lawmakers. The Senate will be doing those virtually this year. The House will be doing those still in person, but they'll be live streaming them. But those who want to participate would maybe still have to be there in person or submit written comments. And then their full committees will be live streamed as well as their floor debate. Mm-hmm. But some things of note are that masks aren't required. They're just recommended. And lawmakers are also not required to report a positive COVID-19 test, but they are encouraged to do so.
Right. And the minority party here does not agree. But Republicans have the majority in both the Senate and the House, so I guess they determine the legislative session. I saw one notable quote from Senator Joe Bocholm, Democrat from Iowa City. Here's his quote. There's going to be a requirement that I wear a tie and a coat when I'm in the Senate chamber, but no requirement to wear a mask. That's idiotic. That makes no sense. Senator Joe Bocholm of Iowa City. That's all the time we have for now. Katarina Sestarik, IPR's state government reporter, thank you for the update.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the number of people in Iowa with COVID-19 who have died surpassed 4,000. Total COVID deaths in the U.S. now moving toward 400,000, with over 4,000 deaths recorded on just one day, for instance, yesterday. This week, those who got the first dose of COVID vaccine in mid-December here in Iowa got their second doses On Wednesday, I spoke with Dr. Jorge Salinas. He's the hospital epidemiologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, a clinical assistant professor of internal medicine, infectious diseases. He's also a member of the state's advisory board that's making recommendations for vaccine distribution in the state. Dr. Salinas, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Ben.
Give us, please, a snapshot on the status of the vaccine distribution in our state currently.
Iowa, like other states, is building the plane as it's been flown. This is not a vaccine program that existed a few months ago, and therefore there are a few hiccups. This is happening everywhere in the United States and in the world, and we have started the vaccination of healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents with some success. We've deployed more, or we've used more doses than other states, but there is still a long way to go to get these doses where they need to be.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest challenges in the first days of this campaign?
There are many. The fact that we don't know for sure how many doses will be available has led to prioritization of the doses, not necessarily having one way of distributing the doses, but they are distributed slightly differently in each county of the state, following some principles outlined by the state. But overall, each county is running a separate process. So Iowa has 99 slightly different processes going on, and some will be more successful than others. That fragmentation of the response leads to some inefficiencies.
Right. So much expertise on Operation Warp Speed to get these vaccines developed with tremendous success. And now we're seeing, and I wonder if it's unexpected to you, that the distribution is really the bottleneck, is a much bigger challenge than anticipated. Or did experts like yourself see this coming?
I think that this is somewhat expected, again, because we are taking a regional or state and local approach rather than a more centralized federal approach. We saw the exact same thing with testing. Each state had to figure out how to test, and everybody did it the best way they could, but with different timelines, with different efficiencies. So the exact same thing is happening with the deployment of vaccines, even though the CDC, for example, has provided certain recommendations. Some states have decided to come up with their own recommendations, and that has led, again, to some other inefficiencies because our government as a whole has decided to take that approach. I think that some of these inefficiencies were expectable. At the same time, we cannot be hypercritical because, again, this is a brand new vaccination effort. And imagine what kind of vaccination effort. It has to be done emergently. We don't have enough doses. These are brand new vaccine technologies that require special refrigeration, et cetera. So the challenge couldn't be bigger. So even if you have your best people working on this, you should expect hiccups. And we don't have, again, enough doses. And the number of doses will continue growing, hopefully exponentially, as days and weeks go by.
If you've just joined us, my guest, Dr. Jorge Salinas, hospital epidemiologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, also sits on the advisory board that makes recommendations for vaccine distribution in the state. Talk a little bit more about what you briefly mentioned at the start of our conversation, Dr. Salinas, please. The order in which various groups will be vaccinated, frontline healthcare workers receiving their vaccinations, their first doses in mid-December, as I mentioned. Now some vaccinations reaching our seniors living in long-term care facilities. Walk us through those groups and what so that our listeners who belong to some of those groups may know when their turn has arrived.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, unfortunately, it's very clear that the United States doesn't have enough doses for everyone yet. And we won't get to that position until the spring or the summer. So for now, we have to prioritize. There is the phase 1A priority, according to the CDC and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of CDC, it has been healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents. After those groups are finalized, the next tier is constituted by two groups, people over the age of 75, and the second group are some frontline essential workers, first responders, policemen, teachers, workers in the food industry, et cetera. So those are the recommendations of CDC. There is yet another group called 1C that, again, has two groups, one based on age, anyone over the age of 65, and other essential frontline workers. The timing to go from phase 1A to 1B and 1C is not very clear. It has to do more with how many doses are available and how many of those doses have been given to people. I think that Iowans, let's say, that are in the group over the age of 75 may get it next month. People over the age of 65 may take them a couple of months, and so on. For the general public that is not in these age groups and do not have other medical conditions or are not considered essential frontline workers, it's going to take them at least 2 or 3 months. Of mm-hmm. course, this is also dependent on any other breakthroughs, developments. It may be that one or two other vaccines could be approved. If one or two other adenovirus vaccines are approved, we could perhaps have more doses available and we can move through this pipeline much quicker. But with the vaccines that we currently have approved, which are Moderna and Pfizer, it's still going to take a number of months before it gets to the general population.
Right. And so, Perth, you made the point. Let's reiterate it, though. You need to take the same safety precautions that you've always been taking, mask wearing, social distancing, Dr. Salinas.
You got it right. Exactly. So, yes, we are all very enthusiastic with these vaccines and how efficacious they are. But vaccines work at the personal level, yes, but their maximum effect comes from a term that has been repeated often, herd immunity. It comes from the protection that I give you and you give me. When we all have immunity, then is when we are very, very powerful. And we decrease the probability of the virus circulating to close to zero. And that is the beginning of back to normal. And unfortunately, we're not going to get there until nearly 90% of Iowans are vaccinated, and that's going to be in the summer. In the meantime, we have these very effective measures that we have to continue implementing, again, vaccinated or not. I'll throw in another wrench, and it's the fact that there is this new variant that was initially discovered in the United Kingdom, but it's clear that it is circulating in the United States that appears to be more infectious. The good thing is that this variant is not immune to masks, soap, or distance. Mm. So we have to continue implementing these public health measures, even though we've started vaccination, even if I am personally vaccinated, we should continue implementing them.
And of course, one of the factors that has been watched perhaps in past weeks more than it is now, the attitudes. These are not mandatory vaccinations. These are voluntary. So it takes a public awareness a campaign to address safety concerns people may have. What are you seeing there? Because in the very early weeks, even before the vaccines, first shots were given, there was a significant portion of our country's population that was skeptical about the safety. What changes have you seen there?
Well, in general, currently we're only vaccinating healthcare workers, and they are taking it. They want it. They're very eager to get the vaccine. But I do understand why some populations may be hesitant because of historical trends, medical mistreatment of certain ethnic groups, historically again, or because you don't want to be an early adopter. Please know that many scientists, both in the federal government, in academia, in universities, doctors, etc., have evaluated the data that has been made available, that is public, that we all have had a chance to study, that 70,000 people, mostly Americans, have been part of clinical trials to ascertain that this vaccine is highly efficacious, one of the most efficacious vaccines that we have, and that this vaccine is safe. We do know that this vaccine has some side effects or adverse events, some reactogenicity. Your immune system shows some signs when it interacts with this vaccine. But that is completely expectable. The signs and symptoms are mild, some arm soreness, and after the second dose, perhaps some headache or fever or just body aches that last for a day or two, that are definitely milder and definitely better than getting the disease, COVID-19, and the possibility of passing the disease to other people. So please know that these vaccines have been heavily scrutinized, heavily vetted by scientists throughout the world and throughout the United States. And if the FDA and the CDC have approved them, it's because they believe, with all the information that we have currently available to us, that these vaccines do work and are safe.
Okay, thank you very much for the update. Dr. Jorge Salinas, hospital epidemiologist with the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Salinas, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
All that's left to do on this News Buzz edition of River to River is to be grooved into the weekend. CeCe Mitchell is with us, IPR Studio One Tracks host. CeCe, hi.
Hey there, Ben. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear. I'm going to anoint you the musical doctor. I need some remedy here after this week. All of us do. Yep. What do you have?
So this time of year is actually pretty slow for music releases, but I dug around and found a couple because I knew we were in for a need of some new music. This first one is from Passenger's new album. We knew him from, he had a top 40 hit. It was Let Her Go. He's this singer-songwriter out of Britain. It's a breakup album, but it's kind of interesting because instead of doing all these breakup songs from himself, he's singing about like stories of characters in a dive bar. That's the concept. So this one's going to be the title track, A Song for the Drunk and Brokenhearted by Passenger.
Sunday afternoon, September's golden brown. Summer always fades too soon, like the laughter of a clown. Shadows fill the room, where sorrows come to drown. Your heart's a lead balloon, as you sink another one down. I know it numbs the way you feel, blurs what is right and what is real, and there's no love left you can steal. For the joker laughs along as he gestures out of smart.
CeCe, what would you give to have that voice? Amazing.
Right. Yeah.
We have time for one more. Take us out with one more to groove us into the weekend, please, CeCe.
Yep. This song comes from a sort of stomp and holler rock band out of Iceland, Kaleo. They've also had some hits in the past few years. Music is really easy to listen to. I have in my notes that this is the sort of stuff that I'll play in my headphones when I'm walking to work to try to feel cool. It's from their new record, Surface Sounds. This track is Break My Baby by Kaleo.
We all turn the blind eye. You know I've got your back. Would you ever do that for me?
Okay, keep that music under me, please. And we'll just mention that CeCe Mitchell is IPR Studio One Tracks host, along with Tony Daner and Mark Simmet. Get your best daily soundtrack, new music, old favorites from our Studio One gang. Thanks, CeCe.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.